Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Heart to Health Talk. I'm Zi Xing.
And I'm Sheng Hao. So in today's episode, we're going to be talking about telehealth, a service that has recently been gaining traction. And joining us is Mr. Darren Loke, the founder of Igaku. So Darren, would you like to introduce yourself and maybe what your company does for our listeners?
Okay, sure. So thank you guys for having me. And basically, I'm Darren. I'm the founder of Igaku. And basically, Igaku is a telehealth platform which aims to improve the accessibility of healthcare to different communities. Right now, our main focus is, of course, within Indonesia. So we have linked up both patients in rural areas to healthcare providers within the cities in Jakarta. And we've also helped communities within the cities, either the upper class who want to reach better quality healthcare from overseas, like in Penang or Singapore, to do so. And we also do help kind of aggregate medication delivery from Singapore or Malaysia over to Indonesia as well.
I'm actually pretty curious. So this is a startup that you launched a couple of years back, I believe.
Yeah, so it's actually kind of a funny story. So we actually started out, like, kind of the idea for Igaku was kind of in the oven baking for, you know, since about 2018, but I couldn't really properly execute on it until my second year of uni, so that was 2019. And, you know, there were a lot of challenges, you know, and why we kind of couldn't get it off the ground for the initial period, and that was due to a lot of technical issues and just trying to get an alpha or prototype out. That was probably the biggest struggle because, you know, I didn't come from a tech background back then. I didn't have a CTO with me, so we really had to outsource a lot of it to, like, freelancers.
Wow. So it sounds like since your second year, and you've recently graduated, right? So that was like 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
2 years ago, 2 years ago.
I think it's really impressive that you started a company while still schooling.
Oh yeah, that was pretty tough actually. Especially with, you know, NTU's kind of curriculum where, you know, versus NUS where business is 4 years, NTU is 3 years. So it is a little bit more condensed in that sense. So when the SEMs get busy, it can get pretty busy actually.
All right, so actually, briefly, what does telehealth and telemedicine actually mean? And is there a difference between the two terms?
Well, you know, actually, right about now, telehealth and telemedicine are used kind of loosely and pretty much interchangeably. But, you know, from my perspective, telemedicine tends to focus a little bit more towards the medical side of things. So, you know, I'm going to matchmake you directly with a doctor, or if I'm a doctor, I'm going to video call you directly, and we're going to use proper diagnostics, maybe. If you happen to have any wearable medical devices or medical technology that could help us reach a more accurate diagnosis, that's kind of telemedicine. But telehealth can be seen as a little bit more holistic in the sense where it can encompass other specializations outside of, you know, your standard doctors and GPs or your specialists. Because I think another useful kind of application for telehealth is either, you know, counseling. So you can speak to a psychologist online, or some people have even moved into physiotherapy, where these guys aren't doctors per se, but, you know, they're still within the healthcare ecosystem. These are all allied healthcare professionals. So, you know, if I'm a psychologist giving you a counseling session right now, I can't say like, okay, yeah, this is, you know, telemedicine. You know, I'm not a doctor. I can't diagnose you, but I am still treating you. I'm still helping you with an aspect of your healthcare. And that's why it's kind of telehealth. And telehealth is a little bit more holistic in that sense.
So in that case, does Igaku provide telemedicine or telehealth?
Yeah, so I think we're actually more towards the telehealth side because we actually do have a few other professionals on our platform as well, such as psychologists and well-known physiotherapists within Indonesia. But, you know, as I mentioned before, the two terms nowadays are used very loosely between each other. They are very similar. And as an average Joe, if you tell me telehealth or telemedicine, I'm just going to assume they're the same thing. Because, you know, most of the time, if someone says, I'm going to go see a psychologist versus I'm going to see a psychiatrist, I think most everyday person is just going to be like, well, what's the difference? You know, to me, it sounds like the same thing where they don't realize that a psychiatrist is actually a doctor. A psychologist is more of a healthcare professional.
And perhaps on that topic, I'm actually a bit curious as well about sort of the onboarding process or the sort of customer journey for the telehealth industry. Maybe you can't speak for the entire industry, but perhaps your experience working with your clients and customers in Igaku. So how does that process kind of work?
So you mean in terms of getting the customers or getting the patients or getting the doctors?
I mean, perhaps more for the patient side.
Okay, sure. So I think when we first started out, you know, everyone always kind of brought up the fact that, you know, there's a kind of a chicken before the egg issue in any kind of platform that you're trying to start out with, not just like telemedicine, but even if, say, it's an e-commerce site, for example, you know, who's going to be the supplier versus who's going to be the buyer? You know, you have to have kind of both. If, say, the buyer says, okay, there's no one here to provide the service for me, there's no one for me to buy anything from, so I'm not going to join. And on doctor side, there are no patients here, or, you know, there's no buyers here, so I'm not going to join. So you kind of have a chicken before the egg problem. And I think one thing that we had to do and what we kind of did to circumvent that was target the doctors first, because, you know, at the end of the day, the doctors don't have anything to lose, and we don't charge, at least for what we do, we don't have a subscription fee or anything. You know, if you want to, you just sign up as a doctor, it's free. If we happen to get any patients, we will always promise them that we will refer the patients to you. And we try to make sure that we don't have too many overlapping specialties on board, because then you have an issue of cannibalization where, you know, this doctor is going to complain like, hey, I'm a cardiologist, why do you have five other cardiologists on this platform? So, you know, we try to limit how many we have so there isn't too much cannibalism happening within the app itself. So what we had to do was start out with getting the doctors on board before you can start approaching the patients. And the tricky thing about selling a service like this is really the red tape around it. So when it comes to like setting up a business, say for example, you're setting up some e-commerce store selling cupcakes or something, like you have a home bakery, you can just launch some Facebook or Instagram ad campaigns and get it out there, and which is exactly what we did. But the specific challenges that come with what we do is that we're not able to just advertise so freely as well, because there are a lot of laws regarding medical advertising. There's certain things you can say. You can't publicize any specific medications. You can say that we can offer you a certain like treatment, or like if you're looking for something, but we can't put a medication brand or a specific treatment and advertise that, because that would, you know, be against law. But again, with any business, the best way to reach out to your consumers is really just through marketing, which is, as a startup, your most approachable manner would just be through like Google AdWords or Facebook ads. So as of right now, actually, we're still trying to invest more of our time towards that. One mistake that we made earlier on was trying to onboard business development people within Indonesia to try and go out there and find patients for us. But, you know, that wasn't the most effective way, because it's not like I'm selling a big ticket item where, you know, you can just walk up to someone and like, hey, would you like to like buy some medication from overseas? It's not like, you know, selling insurance. I can't just like send out a group of people to do that. So realized, yeah, a little bit too late that we have to be a bit more aggressive on the social media marketing side if you want to get patients.
So I understand that telehealth, there are different services like this. Telemedicine, which is where the patient goes onto the teleconsult and they have a diagnosis made. And there's also telemonitoring, which is perhaps for chronic diseases, and there's regular consultations needed. So I was wondering, earlier you mentioned about wearables, if whether the patient had any wearables to track any health statuses. So I was wondering, for telehealth to work, does it mean that every patient needs to have a health wearable?
Not necessarily. So, I mean, as you probably have seen with a lot of telemedicine apps that are out there in the market right now, with Doctor Anywhere or BookDoc and whatnot, they don't actually require you to use any wearable technology. While I'm sure they have their own partnerships, and, you know, us as well, we're working towards getting those partnerships where we can kind of bundle these things together and you can have more accurate diagnoses. But it's not really a necessity as of right now, you know, especially given the fact that for some of the conditions that people are going to see a GP online for, if it could just be like a common cold or a cough, for example, let's ignore like the whole COVID pandemic in this scenario, because, you know, the second you have any of those symptoms, you will have to get swabbed right away. But say in a normal situation, if you happen to just be going in for something mild and nothing nefarious that requires a further treatment, then I guess telemedicine doesn't require any kind of assistive diagnostic tools. But the primary disclaimer, and I guess the main issue that, you know, most doctors, especially within the context of Singapore, because our laws are pretty harsh and comprehensive when it comes to anything healthcare related, is that any missteps or misdiagnoses can result in the doctor getting into some trouble. Because at the end of the day, you know, I'm seeing you over a video. I can't really look at your vitals. That's why a lot of telemedicine companies have to position themselves as not really being a this doesn't replace an in-person consultation. This is kind of like medical advice, which you can choose to take, but, you know, it does not replace an in-person consultation. The usual, like, you know, we don't accept any liabilities for that sort of thing. So, yeah, basically, I don't think that wearable tech is a necessity, but it really will help in terms of cutting down on a lot of the misdiagnoses that could potentially happen, especially with stuff that's more serious than your typical common cold and whatnot.
And given that you mentioned the disclaimer that all these telehealth and telemedicine companies kind of have to give, given the regulatory scene in Singapore as well, do you think that that could be a reason that sort of it disincentivizes people from using telehealth versus like traditional consultation?
Yeah, and I mean, within the context of Singapore, at least from, you know, when we first started out, we tried to break into the Singapore market. But, you know, aside from there being a lot of incumbent players, you know, the main thing is also the psychographic of the Singaporean consumer. So, and also just, you know, the general context within Singapore is that if, say, I'm staying in even like any HDB flat or any condo, all I have to do is just take the lift down and there's a GP just like right underneath my block. So why do I need telemedicine? And, you know, I think the apprehension comes from both sides, both on the doctor side where like, hey, I don't want to risk losing or getting into any trouble, which, you know, may result in me losing my medical license. And, you know, on the patient side, I want to make sure that I'm getting a proper diagnosis. So I think that maybe there's a little bit of that issue or, you know, a little bit of that inertia in kind of the uptake of telemedicine. But the real game changer was probably COVID. Interestingly, that's when the pandemic was kind of the turning point for telemedicine, where both on the doctor side and the patient side, you see a shift in their psychographic where the patient says, you know what, I don't want to risk going to a clinic. And, you know, if some COVID patient was there getting a swab test, I don't want to be anywhere near that. That's when the pros outweigh the cons of telemedicine. That's where the strengths come in. And same thing with the doctors as well. Like, if I can minimize my risk of coming into contact with certain patients, then it's a benefit for me as well. And anyways, like, these patients don't want to come in. This is kind of a good replacement.
Personally, I really empathize with the idea of not having to go down to the clinic. Because recently I went for a clinic appointment and I was waiting 45 minutes just to collect my medicine. At a point in time, I was really just so frustrated. And at a 45 minute mark, I was just almost out of my mind. Why couldn't this just be sent to me? Or why couldn't it just be done online when the consult was only 10 minutes? So I think I can see, especially with COVID, more people will be forced to use this option, and also it will become much more normalized to use it, right? So one thing I was actually quite interested in that you mentioned previously was that in Singapore, there are a couple of laws that prevent you from allowing the doctors to make a diagnosis, but instead to only give a medical advice, to claim it as a medical advice. So do you think that these laws would change? And do you think that an accurate diagnosis is something that is achievable in the future through telemedicine?
You know, recently MOH had a sandbox for telemedicine. I'm not sure if you guys had heard of it, but it was basically just a sandbox to kind of test out some of the major, telemeds to see, you know, can this work? And I was actually going to join it, but they told me that, oh, no, it's fine. It's not necessary. Just continue doing what you're doing. But I think the main point was kind of just for them to just do a proof of concept and see, you know, is this a viable way forward for us? And in fact, a lot of the hospitals themselves actually do have telemedicine capabilities, but they're just not really using them as of yet. You know, Tan Tock Seng has a telemedicine platform, but it's just not actively being used at the moment. Don't take my word for it, but it's just from, you know, my contacts that we've spoken to who work within Tan Tock Seng. They've told us that, you know, it's not in use at the moment. There could be a lot of reasons for that. It could be regulatory. You know, maybe they're still testing it out, but we can't really say too much about that because we don't know. But moving forward, the main problem with telemedicine right now is that as much as we talk about how convenient it could be, at the end of the day, I mean, it is really just a video call between a doctor and a patient. You're just aggregating that demand between them and pairing them up. That's really all there is to it. And the main limitation right now is the hardware that we're doing it on. Like, our smartphones can read certain vitals, but it's not that accurate yet. Even with COVID right now, we're just starting to get those cameras that can kind of detect your body temperature and whatnot, but it's not really implemented into commercial use devices. So you don't see Logitech creating these home devices that can detect your body temperature. And I can't say for sure when this might happen, but we probably have to work towards a future so when, like, you know, our personal devices can kind of assist in making more accurate diagnoses, because, you know, right now we're really just limited by the hardware that we have. So they could be in another 10 years or another 20 years before we start seeing radical changes in consumer technology that would allow telemedicine to just be used, you know, very accurately.
This kind of reminds me also of how, like, you know, if you're talking about things like IoT being adopted in, like, smart homes, smart offices, smart buildings, right? So I'm supposing that this could also be like this, a similar kind of network of, like, connected devices, right? So if you're like wearing, you have like wearables like everywhere, and it's connected, it's able to send some kind of feedback back to your system or your mobile device, and then you can track. You know, I think it would be pretty complicated if you're like wearing 10 different wearables all at once, just to sort of simulate that kind of reliability or accuracy of a real life doctor consultation face to face. But that would be like something that could be in the future, right?
Yeah, so I mean, I completely agree with you on that. Like, you know, all these IoT devices that we talk about, they're probably going to be the way forward in terms of kind of that wearable technology that we're always talking about. But I do think that that's going to be way far off in the future, and that's going to be another set of, like, you know, legal and ethical issues going behind it, right, as well, because, you know, all these medical device companies who are creating it, you'll have legislators and you're gonna have consumers coming in being like, well, how much of my data do you have access to, and, like, you know, do you have access to, like, you know, everything that's going on in my body 24/7, and, you know, how much of that data do you, are you able to, like, look at? So I think humanity will cross that bridge when we get there. But yeah, I don't foresee it being a very straightforward process, if I have to be honest.
I think one of the concerns that people might have, as you mentioned, would be privacy concerns. I was wondering whether these concerns are valid, or whether the technology nowadays does ensure that your privacy will be protected during these consults.
I mean, I can't say too much about Singapore's regulations regarding this one, but from what I know, and especially with Indonesia, from where we're operating in, there aren't too many regulations, you know, regarding the usage of telemedicine. There are some licenses that you can apply for, and, you know, and some precautions you can take in order to, like, make sure that there is as little risk as possible, such as making sure your servers are based within the country that you're operating in, so that way there isn't, like, patient information from say Indonesia going to somewhere in, like, China, for example. Yeah, as long as, you know, the patient data is stored within each individual country, there shouldn't be too much of a problem. But right now, there is actually this thing called HIPAA, which is dictated by the U.S. It's basically a set of guidelines that's been given out in the U.S. for how patient data and patient records should be kept. But right now, it only really applies to the U.S. And from what I know, other countries like Singapore and Indonesia have not adopted it yet. But at some point, with the technology that we have right now and kind of the uptake that you've seen in telemedicine over the past year due to the pandemic, I would expect that we're going to be seeing more compliance heading our way. In fact, I believe MOH kind of released a circular not long ago saying that there will be some regulations kind of put on telemedicine companies come 2022. So we don't know what they are yet, but, you know, we know that there are some regulations that are coming. We've kind of been speaking to them about it briefly, but we know that it's coming.
I think shifting the conversation a bit away from regulations and back to just telehealth, we're a bit curious about also the kind of customers that you usually get. Is it more about, like, older patients that come to consult you for telehealth consultations, or is it that younger demographics who are, you know, more tech savvy and a bit more familiar with these kind of digital consultations?
So basically, from our kind of USP or selling point within Indonesia, is that we're offering a more premium / personalized service to a lot of the Indonesian consumers who are there. And I guess just for a bit of contextual information, about 1.2 million Indonesians usually travel from Indonesia to either Singapore or Malaysia during non-pandemic periods for medical tourism purposes. And this could be either to see a favorite specialist in either Penang or Singapore, or to buy medication from either Singapore or Malaysia. And right now, because of the pandemic and travel restrictions, they are unable to do so. That's basically the crowd that we're targeting right now. And usually from what we've seen, the demographic is usually about 50 plus. I mean, generally as young people, we're probably not as concerned about our health yet. Even if we may get like chronic illnesses somewhere down the road, it hasn't really hit us yet. You know, we're still young and healthy, you know, so we don't have too many health issues to begin with. And I think generally when the young people see a doctor, it's either to get some simple thing treated, like, you know, common cold and whatnot, or for something more like birth control. That's actually what you see a lot of, is people who need to get a prescription for birth control. So the two major telemedicine players within Indonesia, called Halodoc and Allodoctor, they pretty much dominated the mass market over there. And the two of them are currently engaged in basically a price war. I think a few months ago, they were both basically offering free consultations, just trying to like outdo each other. And right from the get-go, we knew we can't compete with that. No way we can compete with what they're doing at the scale of what they're doing, because these guys are, they're well-funded, large, and they're targeting the masses. And, you know, that's not something we're going to be able to do. So for our general target demographic, we're looking at maybe the top 10 to 15% in Indonesia, and maybe those who are around 30 plus, usually 30 or older. And the reason why we're looking at those who, you know, might not have any health conditions yet, like, you know, at 30, you're still young enough. You may or may not have like some chronic health issues popping up. But the main reason why is because they're usually the caretakers of their elderly parents. And that's actually something we've been seeing a lot of with some of our patients coming in. Normally when they register on our landing page, it's usually someone in their 30s or 40s, and we find out, hey, I'm actually looking for a orthopedic surgeon for my dad who's like in his 70s or something. And we kind of liaise with them and arrange the appointment and, you know, what else they need together with them. So basically, like, even though the older generation may not be as tech savvy, they will either depend on their like kids or their grandkids to do it. And it's quite interesting because usually it's either the kids who see our ad running on social media, or the elderly people themselves see it and they'll ask their kid, like, I want to try this out. Can you like help me sign up for it or contact these guys? So yeah, basically our target audience is a little bit older, but we also kind of aim to cast a net out to catch like 25 to 30 something year olds, because they're usually the kids or grandkids of their elderly parents who would be the ones looking for this service.
I'm a bit surprised that the elderly, are they not like a little skeptical or suspicious of digital consultations, you know, given that they spend, you know, pretty much the bulk of their lives doing face-to-face consultations, and now, you know, you see this doctor's face on the screen. Is it difficult to convince them to sort of give it a try?
Yeah, actually, you know, that's something that we thought was pretty interesting as well, because naturally we kind of assumed that most of them would be a little bit more averse to using this technology. And while I think that's generally still holds true for the majority of the population, or just a lot of them, but a lot of them have also started to kind of realize that right now, if I want to see a doctor overseas, I don't really have any other choice. Or if I want to get medication from overseas, I also don't really have much of a choice. I, you know, we can try to use the service that these guys are offering and don't really have that much to lose. And from there, it's just about really giving them good customer service and making sure that we're fulfilling their needs, getting their feedback, and then hoping that we can kind of create that stickiness with them, and they'll hopefully choose to stay with us even after this pandemic is over.
So that is kind of more for your Indonesian patients that wanted to travel for medical tourism. But what do you think about, like, let's say the Singapore market, like elderly living in Singapore, since they are not exactly that same demographic, would they be more skeptical?
Well, I mean, in my opinion, I do think most of them would be quite skeptical. Again, you know, it goes back to the previous point we were discussing earlier about how convenient Singapore already is. The only thing that we kind of foresee, you know, maybe telemedicine being used for in Singapore could be kind of a point that you kind of brought up earlier, of, you know, when you're sitting at the clinic for 45 minutes waiting for the medication to come. The one pain point that I feel exists in Singapore is that if you go to a polyclinic, for example, it's relatively affordable. I wouldn't say it's cheap, it's affordable. And you can go there, you know, you can get your medication. It's probably subsidized by MediSave or MediShield. But of course, the main down point to it is that, you know, everyone else is also using it. So naturally, there's quite a large queue most of the time, you know. And if, say, you want to get a referral to NUH, you may have to wait quite a while. I personally have had to wait like 2 months for my appointment at any wage this one time. At that point, I was telling the GP, if I had to wait 3 months, I might not even have like this problem anymore. So I think it's, you know, a little bit too long to wait. That's your first option. And your second healthcare option is with private healthcare guys. But of course, it's just way, way, way more expensive. You know, your consult fee is already like $100 to $200. And the medication can be even more expensive. But of course, the pros in that case is that it's just way faster. You're not going to have to wait months for your next appointment in most cases. Again, it's kind of like, would you rather pay less for waiting a longer time, or do you want to pay more and not have to wait so long? So that's kind of the trade-off you have to make. And basically, a service like ours could potentially come in as maybe you pay a little bit more than what you would pay at a polyclinic, because, you know, we're not covered under like MediShield or MediSave or whatever. And you can get your medications delivered to you. It would still be cheaper than, say, going to a private hospital here. But of course, it may not be as fast because you still have to wait for the delivery to happen. But you know, you kind of pick and choose what you want and how much you're willing to spend. So maybe that's a little niche where telemedicine could come in for some of the older people where, you know, they don't want to wait so long and they don't want to pay so much. But from what I've seen, at least with my own grandparents, is that they don't really mind waiting because, you know, when you're old and retired, you actually have a lot of time. So the waiting probably doesn't matter too much to you. So, you know, I do think that it's a little bit harder for like the elderly in Singapore to maybe want to take up using technology like telemedicine.
Perhaps one area that I can imagine telemedicine might become more popular with among the elderly would be under geriatrics medicine. So if I remember, my grandpa, he used to have calls from CGH, the integrated building, I think, for his Alzheimer's. So instead of just going back to just get a quick check on what his progression in Alzheimer's is, it was much easier for them to just pick up a call and just call him to ask him a few questions and check his state of conscience. Yeah, I suppose that might be something we can look forward to. And with that, perhaps I can wrap up with one last question. Are you optimistic about the spread of telemedicine in Singapore, regardless of whatever age or what disease it is?
You know, I think that telemedicine itself has a lot of potential, even within the case of Singapore. But I think the Singapore market right now still has, you know, a fair bit of inertia in terms of picking up telemedicine as a primary care option. Right now, during the pandemic, you've maybe seen an uptick in usage, but, you know, we're not sure how that's going to translate to after the pandemic has ceased and everyone feels more secure going back. You know, in Indonesia, the usage of telemedicine has always been kind of high, actually, because I think the psychographic there is just that they're more in tune into like, you know, taking up a new technology such as telemedicine. We're not exactly sure why yet, but it just is more widespread. Even before the pandemic, it was used more extensively within Indonesia. But in Singapore, you know, if, say, there are more regulations, that's just another obstacle for new entrants to come in, which is a good and bad thing. But more regulations could also kind of control what the current players in the Singapore market are able to do as well. So I think it's a little bit hard to say what the outlook is going to be like within the Singapore context right now, but we're really just going to have to wait and see what happens over the next year, which is basically after the pandemic is over and when the new guidelines for telemedicine have been released. Then we'll probably have a clearer picture as to the trajectory of whether telemedicine is going to take center stage in Singapore, or at least be one of the primary care options, or if it's just going to kind of like fall off. So we're really just going to have to wait and see.
For an impatient person like myself, I think I do hope that the legislation will be enough to ensure that telehealth services can operate safely, but still not so much that it prevents them from operating in a comfortable manner.
Yeah, definitely, for sure.
All right, then with that, thank you very much for having this conversation with us today. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you want to find out more about health and tech, or hear about similar experiences, follow us at our social media platforms at Heart to Health Talk. That's at Heart to Health Talk, where additional resources and nuggets of wisdom can be found. Hope to catch you in our next episode. Bye!